the world entirely is at war.
Troops waiting for the zero hour.
This is D-Day.
They got one.
Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join host Gene Pell and an honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and fighting aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories from World War II...
A state of war!
...to the present day.
Allied Air Forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait.
Now the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network present Veterans Chronicles with your host, Gene Pell.
Welcome to this week's edition of Veterans Chronicles. My guest is Army Major Jason Amerine, a graduate of the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, and a leader of Army Special Forces, who played a pivotal role in ousting the Taliban regime in Afghanistan. This is his story.
I grew up in Honolulu, Hawaii, and as a whole, Hawaii's a very pro-military state. You have so many people who've served, have family members who served. I enlisted in the 442nd at the end of my junior year of high school and served in, you know, that unit, which has a really rich heritage with the state of Hawaii as the all-Japanese unit of World War II. I did high school ROTC, which also is very popular in the state. And one of my instructors was a retired Special Forces sergeant named Howard Noe. And as a 14-year-old, getting to know him, I mean, really from that year on, I wanted to be in Special Forces, so I kind of aimed in that direction. Did 4 years at West Point, was an infantryman, and when I made captain, I went into the Special Forces.
What about language training?
I was interested in languages. In high school, I studied a little bit of Russian, took German and Japanese, and then at West Point, I majored in Arabic and also took Spanish. So I've studied five languages. Can't claim to speak any of them terribly well, but at least I'll have a little bit of experience in each of them.
So by the time you found your way to Afghanistan, you could at least do some communicating.
Definitely. A funny thing in Afghanistan is most of the dialects are similar to Farsi. The language that I spoke the best, Arabic, wasn't something I could really use over there. And when I'd actually try speaking Arabic, even the people who understood it wouldn't want to speak it to me because the way they viewed it, the Arabs were the enemy of the United States, mm-hmm. and they didn't want to look like our enemy. Mm-hmm. So they'd laugh, say, Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda, and they wouldn't speak to me. But we could speak Russian to them, and we could speak Farsi, but we couldn't speak Arabic, and it was kind of interesting to me.
That's a very interesting story, considering the Russian history in that part of the world.
And the Russians were defeated.
And they were defeated, absolutely. Right. Well, what was the path from graduating from West Point to getting to the Middle East?
When I graduated from West Point, I wanted to get out and start seeing the world. My father moved my family to Hawaii to study anthropology, and I grew up listening to all the stories of just all the amazing cultures that the anthro students would study. So that was what I wanted out of my Army career, was to get out and see the world. So I elected for a tour in Panama. So my first assignment was in Panama, where I served for 2 years as a rifle platoon leader and then a company executive officer. And then I still wasn't ready to come back to the U.S., so I volunteered for a consecutive overseas tour, and I found myself in Panmunjom, Korea, as the executive officer of a ROC, or Republic of Korean Infantry Company, doing the DMZ patrols. And I joke with people, that was the best Special Forces job of my career, and I was an infantry lieutenant. So I got to live with my 200 Korean soldiers, work with them, go out on the combat patrols with them. It was an amazing time.
And then from there?
After Korea, I came back to the U.S. For the advanced course. I'd been promoted to captain, and I elected for Special Forces Assessment Selection, where they basically try to kill you for about 3 weeks, and if you endure it, then they accept you for the Special Forces training. And that was the really funny part, was I still wanted to stay overseas, and I figured by going Special Forces, I would. And I found myself stationed outside of Nashville at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, which had me kind of scratching my head, but they definitely kept us deployed a lot.
Mm-hmm. But then you finally got to, which I forget, was it Kazakhstan or Kyrgyzstan?
Right. When I went to Special Forces and went to 5th Group, my first real overseas work was in Kuwait as part of our rotations there to, defend Kuwait against Iraq. And then I did some other, short missions here and there. And then I took over my second detachment. I commanded two Special Forces teams, ODA 572, then ODA 574. When I took over 574, our mission was to work in Kazakhstan for the better part of a year. So in the year leading up to 9/11, I spent much of the year flying back and forth to Kazakhstan to train their paratroopers. And they had an insurgency that was sponsored by the Taliban called the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan that they were fighting. So we were really teaching counterinsurgency skills to the Kazakhs.
What did you learn in counterinsurgency and the techniques yourself? Campbell?
There are a couple ways to answer that. I mean, basic counterinsurgency, when you look at the military tactics, it's military patrolling. It's actually very basic infantry skills that I learned as an infantryman. So that was a big part of what we were teaching them, was just how to fight, how to do small unit tactics, how to conduct ambushes, how to conduct raids. The combat aspects of a counterinsurgency.
Right. But then there's the political side.
Right, and that's the other side that we learn in Special Forces, where you talk about good governance, where you talk about building up infrastructure, building an economy, building up a professional military, and so on.
And how to eat soup with a knife?
Ah, right. Colonel Nagel, his book, great man.
What kind of U.S. presence was there in Kazakhstan? Just you and a handful?
Kazakhstan was definitely warming up to the United States. They didn't want to anger the Russians, who they also needed as an ally. But Kazakhstan has been and will continue to be very afraid of the Chinese, which is kind of an interesting aspect of it all. So they see their relationship with the United States really as a way of countering the threat of China. That goes hand in hand with their friendship with the Russians. So they've been opening up for a number of years, and they've had 82nd up there. They've had a lot of military units training up there, but generally not many at a time. Just one unit will train with them and then leave. So when I was there, we're the only Special Forces team training with them at the time, the only military unit training with them at the time.
And you were there on 9/11, 2001.
Right. We'd been there for about, I guess we'd been there for about 3 weeks when September 11th occurred. We're right there at the end of our training and getting ready to come home. Then after September 11th, because the air flights were frozen, we ended up staying there about another 10 days.
So what were your thoughts when you heard about the attack in New York, Washington, and the crash in Pennsylvania?
It's funny the clarity one has. I received a phone call from my liaison working at the American Embassy in Almaty, Dan Pettitore, because we're actually outside of Almaty in Kopchagai training the paratroopers. And Dan called and first to tell us that there had been an accident in the World Trade Center. Then he called back later, clearly in tears, to tell us that, in fact, the World Trade Center had been attacked and what was going on. And there was no question in our minds that it was Al-Qaeda and it was going to be a war in Afghanistan. We knew it. No doubt, no question. It was just, okay, let's get back and get ready for the war. There was no special intel being fed to us. We're just very aware of the terrorist threats. And I don't know. So there was that clarity that came with it.
But you surely couldn't have had that kind of clarity about the fact that 3 days later you were going to be in the Afghan countryside yourself.
Well, we were actually afraid that we wouldn't get a mission. It was one of those things where we didn't know what kind of a campaign would begin. There were all sorts of ideas being thrown around. Maybe we'd stay in Kazakhstan and actually invade Afghanistan from the north with the Kazakhs, things like that. But ultimately, at the end of about 10 days, we flew back to the United States and went into a deliberate planning process where we did some last-minute training and equipping, and we went in isolation in preparation to invade Afghanistan.
One of the things that intrigues me is the fact that when you got in there, you went in with the force of what, about 12 of you?
Initially, my team went in Afghanistan with nine. Because of weight restrictions, we had to bring in our other two guys about 4 days later.
Mm-hmm. And did you make immediate contact with Hamid Karzai's forces?
Yeah, there were actually two steps to this. Initially, we flew down to Pakistan, and we began some of our planning and stuff from Pakistan. And then when we infiltrated to this town that was west of Terrencode in Uruzgan province, and that is where we linked up with what few men Karzai had. And at the time, on the ground, he only had about a dozen guys that met us, and then later... We figure he probably had a force of somewhere between 40 and 50 guys.
That's small.
Right.
And when did you first meet him?
We first met him in early November and did some work with him in early November. And then when we infiltrated in mid-November, that was where we began the fight in Afghanistan with him.
And what were your impressions of him?
Hamid Karzai speaks English fluently, almost a slight British accent, very intelligent man, very literate man. When you speak to him, you feel like you're speaking to a statesman, or at least a scholar of some sort. Very insightful, very intelligent. I had to figure out whether or not I trusted him, and he had to figure out whether or not he trusted me and my men.
We're talking this week with Army Major Jason Emmerine about his service in Afghanistan, and we'll continue the conversation after these messages.
What his kid probably went through is the most traumatic thing in his entire life. And you're not ready a week later to go on Oprah and start answering questions about what happened.
Real political talk.
Come on now, you're being cute. You know that you can give tons of money to the 527s and they can do things to support the candidate you want them to support.
Political talk.
They got this guy nailed for everything but impersonating a human being and being a fugitive from the Board of Health.
Political talk with Toad.
The Radio America Network.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell, in conversation this week with Army Special Forces Major Jason Emmerine. In November 2001, he led a small U.S. force into Afghanistan to aid the guerrillas under Hamid Karzai in their fight against the Taliban. Emmerine says that at the outset, he wasn't sure whether Karzai could be trusted, and Karzai wasn't sure about him either. They worked it out.
And so it was almost like we had to open up to each other quite a bit immediately. There wasn't time for any games. So I felt like I got to know him to the point that I trusted him, the insights and the intel that he was providing us in terms of what we'd be doing in southern Afghanistan. And I think he likewise trusted us that we're going to do our best with him. He was always concerned about whether or not we'd abandon him, given the U.S. history in the region. And that was something that, all I could do is assure him that, my team would do its best to live up to all of our obligations to one another for this campaign. And in the end, we did.
But his intelligence and achievements aside, did he have any inkling about any military tactics, for example?
Karzai had no military background whatsoever. And that was actually one of the more difficult things from the beginning, was he didn't believe we actually needed to raise an army. He didn't believe that this would be any kind of combat, that there would be any kind of combat involved in the campaign. He really saw it more as he just needed to negotiate with the tribal belt to get them to roll over and surrender. So my team's role was showing symbolic support to him, and he didn't see it going much beyond that. In fact, he didn't even want my whole team to go in initially. And this was something that, you know, I just had to make it clear to him that that the Taliban were not going to just roll over and die. This was going to get bloody. And I don't think I got that across to him. It was one of those things where I guess we sort of agreed to disagree. But he said he would form an army. My team got on the ground on November 14th. And on November 17th, we found ourselves facing a giant convoy of Taliban coming after us. And after that fight was over, that was when Karzai realized, yeah, we actually do need an army. Because my team found itself at one point all alone because our guerrillas abandoned us. The nine men of my team were sitting outside of town in a couple of pickup trucks directing airstrikes against somewhere between 500 and 1,000 men that were coming to seize the town we're holding.
This was the town of?
This is the town of Terrancote.
Terrancote.
And that,
but they were, but their the objective, as I understand it, was to retake that and strengthen their own then stronghold in Kandahar.
The goal of the campaign was to start in Uruzgan, the birthplace of the Taliban movement, to seize Uruzgan, and then make our way down to Kandahar, where we'd force the Taliban regime in Kandahar to surrender. Kandahar at the time was really the capital of the Taliban, not Kabul. But that was where Karzai and I had a bit of a disagreement in terms of what it would take. I mean, he viewed it as a series of negotiations and nothing more, and I viewed it as negotiations along with an iron fist. So when we got on the ground and were told that the capital of Uruzgan province, Terrancote, had risen up and were inviting us to come take the town, we did it with about 50 guerrillas and my team of nine guys, and that was all we had.
But this convoy was marshaled to come take it back, right?
Right. There was a convoy from Kandahar that was then marshaled to come north and to seize Terrancote from us. So, as I say, within 72 hours, we didn't have, any guerrilla army to speak of. We only had a handful of guerrillas, and even then, as soon as the convoy came within sight of Terrancote, my guerrillas took off and ran, leaving my team to take care of the situation themselves.
Which was done largely with airstrikes you called in?
Right. There were two phases to the fight. My team had found this just incredible ridgeline outside of town with an enormous valley from which to engage the Taliban when they came on the attack. And at that point, we had about 25, 30 guerrillas with us. The Taliban came into the convoy where we expected, when we expected, and all the guerrillas immediately took off and ran. Problem was our guerrillas had the trucks. They had the transportation. My team didn't. So all we could do is retreat with them back into Terrancote. And when we got into Terrancote, told Karzai what happened. He was pretty surprised to see us so soon. We told him we're taking the trucks and heading back out to keep up the fight, told him to send all the men he could. So my team drove back out to the edge of town, and at that point, the skies were filling with F-18s and F-14s. We began directing airstrikes against the convoy. As we're directing the airstrikes, the townspeople started to actually come out, and it almost looked like carnival on the streets. You had old men, young men, you had children, you even had women that were wandering out. Surrounding our trucks right there at the edge of town as we're blowing up the enemy.
After the break, Major Jason Amerine describes how the Taliban was routed, the importance of the victory, and the present and future of Afghanistan. You're listening to Veterans Chronicles on the Radio America Network.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. The center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade,
held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012.
Heavy fighting is still raging.
3,639 wounded.
Red light, green light, and out, out. Get out.
Gentlemen, this is the real thing.
The brutal death march of Bataan.
Germany calling. Germany calling.
Right in the purest face.
That's the ammunition
and the for Harlem operate.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network. Once again, Gene Pell.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell. Army Special Forces Major Jason Amerine led a small force of men into Afghanistan in November 2001 to engage in unconventional warfare against the Taliban regime. He was there only a matter of days when the enemy launched a major assault on the town of Terrencoat in an effort to recapture it from forces loyal to Hamid Karzai, the man destined to become the elected president of the country.
When the Taliban got to the edge of town and started to dismount and begin attacking the town itself, we're able to get the people to fight off the Taliban. And that was where things got pretty dicey again. When we started hearing the small arms fire and started seeing the firefights breaking out around the city, that was sort of the second time that morning. I wasn't sure if we were going to hold on to it. The point at which the Taliban made it into town, my air power was worthless. But in the end, the townspeople fought. They fought off the Taliban that made it to the city. Our aircraft destroyed the rest of the convoy. And by about noon that morning, the Taliban were in full retreat.
Well, the psychological and political effect of that had to have been enormous.
Yeah, that was the thing, is... We'd be directing airstrikes, and we would have some major battles over the next few weeks, but that was the most important event for us in the South. It solidified Karzai as more than just a expatriate that was working from outside of Afghanistan to try to do good things for the country. He was a leader. He was a military leader. You know, he was a statesman in a more well-rounded manner. Karzai was suddenly the man to speak to in the South. He was the Pashtun leader in the South. And the Northern Alliance began talking to him, and he really kind of earned their respect by virtue of that battle. The Taliban had already been talking to him a little bit because they're worried about what he was doing in the South. They just knew that he was somewhere running around, and they didn't know what he was up to. But now they were... definitely speaking very loudly about, you know, what he thought would happen in the long run if the Taliban regime fell. And so for the next few weeks, we continued to build an army, finally raised an army of about 300. We communicated with the Northern Alliance, making sure they stayed in the north and didn't try coming into the Pashtun tribal belt where they might have started a civil war, or restarted the civil war, I should say, since they just lost one. And, you know, we also... talked to the Taliban and, you know, began over the next few weeks to orchestrate the surrender of Kandahar.
So when did the United States finally come to the decision that this was to be the horse they backed?
That was an interesting thing about it. Our initial course of action was to back the Northern Alliance, and I don't think we had a very good understanding of the ethnic geography of Afghanistan itself. The biggest portion of the population, 40%, are Pashtun. The country is traditionally led by a Pashtun leader. For that reason, what we really didn't realize was trying to install an Uzbek, a Tajik, or a Hazara, a Northern Alliance leader, actually would have provoked, you know, again, possibly another civil war, because the Pashtun, the biggest part of the population, were not going to accept anybody but a Pashtun as the leader, at least at that stage. But we had no real Pashtun leaders in the South. Abdul Haq was somebody who was a Pashtun. He was a warlord. He was a veteran. He was somebody who possibly could have had a major role in the government, but he was captured and executed. So when my team went in with Karzai, nobody really viewed him as a serious political leader initially. It was something that really snuck up on everybody. Suddenly on November 17th, we fight for and hold Terrencote. And within the next few days, Karzai is suddenly on the radar as a very important figure. So it really wasn't so much that we decided to back him as suddenly it became obvious that he was a person to back. Prior to that, we just didn't know about him enough. We didn't know his capabilities. We didn't know what he represented. And then all of a sudden, it became very obvious that he was a pretty important figure. My team still didn't think of him as a future leader of the country. We viewed him as an important leader in the future of the country. But we certainly didn't think he was going to be the interim leader and, you know, then elected by Loya Jirga and finally by popular vote as president.
So where are we today? We're now a few years beyond the time frame that you're talking about, or we've been talking about, and what's your assessment of what's happened since?
Karzai has been in power for 6 years. NATO and the United States have been working very hard to establish good governance in the country, to promote stability in the Karzai regime. We've continued to fight al-Qaeda in the border region. We've continued to fight the Taliban. We've fought warlordism. We've attempted to demobilize a lot of the warlord armies of the country. It's been a it's definitely been an uphill fight. It's been a ongoing counterinsurgency operation. As such, in a snapshot, what happened this week, what happened last week, you know, we have good weeks and we have bad weeks. In the long run, I think things are actually going as well as they could be. But that isn't to say that things look like they're all that great. There's still a lot of violence in the country, and the country has a long ways to go. The most important thing, though, is that the people continue to support central governance. They continue to support the Karzai regime. And we're continuing to trudge along and fight this insurgency and try to do what we can to rebuild the country.
What is the basis of the remnants of Taliban sympathizers?
The Taliban are, you know, I think a very misunderstood entity. The Taliban are not a unitary actor. Because the Taliban aren't a unitary actor, it makes analyzing them kind of tricky. You have Pashtun Taliban, you know, in southern Afghanistan, in the areas where I fought. You have Pakistani Taliban in Waziristan that are also mixed with Pashtun Taliban there. And all of these groups that you see across the country each have their own motivations. In some cases, you're talking about tribal elements that simply reject the government, and so they support this overall Taliban insurgency. In other cases, you have people who truly are radicals, and it isn't so much that they're rejecting a government as they're embracing a Taliban ideology, you know, religious extremism. You know, in other cases, you have tribes that are bought off by the Taliban or they're pressured by the Taliban. You know, it's such a complicated animal to try to take down. We're going to see very different strategies in the Pashtun tribal belt of Afghanistan from what we need to do in Waziristan to fight the extremists. And one of the keys, at least for Afghanistan and the Pashtun Taliban, is building good governments, rebuilding the country, and also conducting talks with the tribal elements that support the Taliban, which Karzai has been attempting to do.
How much rebuilding do you think has been accomplished? Or even building and rebuilding?
Right. I can't remember what the latest statistic was for their economic growth. I don't remember if it was 5%. I just don't remember the number off the top of my head, I'm afraid. But when you're starting from zero, you know, anything is better than nothing.
But is there a lot of restructuring of infrastructure going on?
Oh, definitely. One of the biggest things has been roads. Very basic infrastructure. We're not talking about anything terribly complicated. But we've come a very long way in connecting the country with roads. You know, that's definitely been one of the more obvious things that we've done. We've continued to try to build them economically. We've worked with developing schools, all the sorts of infrastructure improvements that you'd want to see in a country that was destroyed by war. It's just a very long, slow process.
Mm-hmm. Go back to the economy and GNP and growth in it aside, you said starting from zero. There was one sector of the economy that did not start from zero and continues to probably be the most influential, is it not, Poppy?
Right. Right. I mean the biggest the biggest money maker informally in the economy is opium. The poppy industry is huge. It's growing. It's never been bigger. And our challenge is to find a way to give the farmers a reason to produce something other than poppy. And until we do that, there's going to be no reason for them to switch, except for us going in and forcing them to. And that's where we play a delicate game. The harder we fight the opium industry, the harder we fight the poppies, the harder it is to, at the same time, maintain stability in a lot of parts of the country, because some of the people who are supporting us now are going to turn against us once they see the poppy industry put under intense pressure. So we need to play a delicate game where we stand up the government, we stand up the Afghan army and the Afghan police, so they're strong enough to handle it when we do start to see a real whiplash by those who are making money off the drug trade.
So it's a minefield for Karzai as well.
It's always been a minefield. I think in the early years of our work in Afghanistan, while a lot of people were screaming really loudly that we were ignoring the poppy crops, it was actually good that we weren't doing too much. And we're slowly ramping up our efforts. But I think that we're doing it in such a way that we're not overwhelming the government by doing so.
How much of a source of revenue is it for the Taliban?
That's something that I'm not sure if anybody could really answer that. It's definitely a source of income. It's definitely a large source of income. But I'm just not sure if it could be said that eliminating the poppy industry means the elimination of the Taliban insurgency. You know, I think that's one of those leaps that you can't necessarily make. But it definitely is a big source of income for them.
So there are other sources of income that continue to be what one considered almost traditional these days, I suppose. Pakistan, resurgence in Pakistan, Al-Qaeda, Iran, undoubtedly. Is that right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. This insurgency isn't based upon the poppy trade, and it's not something that is surviving only by virtue of that money. You have militants across the border. You still have relations between Al-Qaeda and the Taliban in parts of the country. It's a fairly low-tech insurgency that doesn't require a lot of money. When you look at a lot of the tribes that are fighting on behalf of the Taliban, they really they're just alienated tribal elements that live off subsistence agriculture and don't really need it. They don't really need money from the opium industry to endure.
So what's your prognosis? Are you positive, negative, neutral, what?
I'm very positive, but I'm only positive from the perspective of we've stuck with it for 6 years. Karzai's still alive. He's still in power, and things are improving. If suddenly people are clamoring to see major results in the next 5 years, or they'd want us to scale down, something along those lines, then I'd be very negative about it. I still see this as being a good 10 to 15 years before we feel like we've really made significant inroads to the point that we can start bringing the troops home. I mean, I think that our commitment is going to have to remain about where it is. It would be better if we could even put a few more troops over there. You know, I can't quantify those numbers, but when you're looking at what we have over there right now, I think that we have the minimum. I think we could afford to put some more troops over there, and it would make us a bit more effective. But regardless of that, whatever number we have is going to have to stay for a long time before we really feel comfortable bringing people out and not leaving the Afghan government to collapse into chaos.
Our thanks to Army Major Jason Amerine for sharing his experience and insights in Afghanistan. He was the recipient in 2007 of the Paul Ray Smith Award from the American Veterans Center for his leadership and valor in a pivotal moment in the liberation of that country. That's it for this week's edition of Veterans Chronicles, produced by Tim Holbert for the American Veterans Center and Kenny Burns for Radio America in association with Pelcom Communications. I'm Gene Pell. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, veterans, for your service to our country.
The great sea and air battle has been raging in the Solomon area since last Sunday.
From the Radio America Network.